Welcome, my friends. I'm Dave Champion. This is my co-host, Bill Carnes, and together we are
totally unprepared.
So what are we going to talk about today?
Welcome back, Dave.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Yeah. Last time we did a show together was about 4 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
You
had somewhere to be.
I had a guest host in here the first week. The next week, you had a medical procedure.
Yes.
And then the next week, I was supposed to have somewhere to be. It turns out that I didn't have to be there. But then you were also doing some recovery. I guess we'll talk about that in your segment a little bit.
Yes. So I'm going to speak a little bit about the condition of the medical industry. Because the only surgery I've ever had up until this time was outpatient. Mm-hmm. And this one I was told was going to be outpatient until I arrived at the hospital. Then they dropped the bomb that it wasn't. Right? Yeah.
Is this part of the Obamacare scheme?
No, but they really have their act together when they do that, right? I mean, the surgeon's surgery scheduler. Oh, yes. Well, you'll be at the hospital at 1:30 and you'll out by 6.
Yeah, I remember you telling me it'd be
right. And then you get to the hospital and, you know, the doctor comes in and touches base just before they, you know, put you under. What are you talking about going home? You're not going home. Nobody goes home after this. You're staying. What? But and then from there it just went downhill. I'll talk about that. The condition of, because I was naive. I didn't know. I mean, my experience up until this time had been show up. They do what I've had both shoulders done. I've had this arm done twice. You know, outpatient. Show up.
Do their thing.
Five hours later, they're pouring you into the backseat of a car, whatever, and you get driven home, and that's that. So what really goes on in hospitals? I had no clue, but I do now.
So let's talk about something that we were on a few weeks ago, and it came out last week, a change, and that's FBI and phones of alleged terrorists out of San Bernardino. They now rescinded their suit against Apple and claim that they have their own proprietary backdoor into the Apple world.
Yeah, BS. Okay.
So tell me what you found out about
this. Want to hear my take on this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now, you'll remember the core issue of this was that the government was using the All Writs Act to supposedly compel Apple. And I have written and spoken out vociferously on this, that the All Writs Act grants the government no such authority, right? That it's a completely corrupt interpretation. It's like taking some little procedural thing and saying it gives you this much authority. It's ridiculous, right? So... But the government has been employing that routinely, right, all over the place, not just Apple. Apple's the one we know about, right?
Yeah, that's the way they expand their authority more and more rapidly is by getting courts to agree with these ridiculous assertions.
Yes, that's a very good characterization. So, but this time, the wealthiest, most powerful corporation on the planet put its foot down and said no.
Walmart?
No. And one of the things I didn't know until this went down is that Apple funds its legal department with a greater percentage of its money. You know, when you look at how much corporations spend on their legal department, it's one of the top companies for pouring money into its legal division. So it's the wealthiest corporation in the world, and it puts the most money, I don't know if it's number one, but right up there in the top. Of all the corporations in the world, as far as what it funds its legal department with, the volume of money. So all of a sudden, with that dynamic, they say to the government, no. All right? And we're going to fight this. And I read the comments of some of Apple's counsel, and he was spot on that this was basically using the All Writs Act, this little procedural thing, to create slavery, right? To mandate that you will do something you have no desire to do, or you'll go to jail. Crazy. All of a sudden, this giant corporation with a well-funded legal department says, we're going to the mat on this. What was it, like 10 days later? Oh, we found a way into the phone. Bullshit. They did not find a way into the phone. They realized they were going to get their lunch handed to them by the courts. And it's better to use the All Writs Act 127 times in a year on smaller corporations that don't want to fight.
Than it is to lose it. All the way around.
Right, which is what they were facing if they continue with the Apple suit.
Right.
Now, here's a couple things. First of all...
You think they went to John McAfee and had him and his team open it up like they had offered?
No. I don't think they got into the phone at all. I think this is a BS way to get out of the suit, right? They, rather than saying, oh, we're going to get our lunch handed to us and it's going to destroy our ability to intimidate hundreds of other companies around the country, it's, oh, we got into the phone. Now, here's the test of this, whether I'm right or wrong, okay? Because it's just my opinion unless we can test it, yes?
Mm-hmm.
The law enforcement agencies all over America are sitting on iPhones related to crimes that they can't get into.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I heard this story at night after the sun goes down. I can pick up KNX 1070 All News Radio out of LA.
Yeah.
It comes in clear, more clearly here than it does the stations out of Vegas. So when I'm driving around at night and I want to hear the news, I click onto 1070. And I was listening to this the day that this was announced, and they said that LAPD had something like 300 and some odd iPhones.
Right.
And I think LASO had like 152 iPhones, something like that. So
that's
they
just
collectively.
Two agencies.
That's just two agencies
yeah.
that have nearly 500 phones
right.
between them.
I mean, nationwide, we're probably talking tens of thousands of phones.
Right. So are they going to be able to go to the FBI and say, hey, we need help?
Well, this is part of the equation. First of all, you know, in the case of serious crimes, they were going to the FBI, right? And the FBI was telling them no. So wait, so let me see if I understand this right. You've got a homicide case, maybe multiple homicides, and we believe there's evidence in this iPhone. Go to the FBI. No, we can't get into it. But as soon as somebody shoots some people in a government building in San Bernardino, California, voila! Now we can get into the phone, right? It's an absurd proposition to begin with. Now, but that's just setting this up. The true acid test of this is going to be the feedback that we get, that the media gets, from these law enforcement agencies that have these tens of thousands of phones that the FBI says now they can get into. Because the feedback we should be getting if the FBI is telling the truth, and I say that they're lying through their teeth, the feedback we should be getting if they're telling the truth is that we should see all these cases begin to move forward as the FBI gets into the phones and provides local law enforcement with the data that they've been seeking. And I don't, you're not going to see. Now, you may see it on older iPhones running older iOS. But when you get to the five category, you know, the iPhone 5 and later, and running 8 and above, but pretty much 9, okay, which...
The operating system, you mean?
Yes. The iOS is 9 dot whatever, okay. But 8 is where they really started getting... Apple started getting very serious on security, and 9 is the phone that out of San Bernardino that they claim they broke. So what they're claiming is the later hardware with the latest software, we can get into that. Okay. Most of these phones, these tens of thousands we're talking about, are older than that because they've been sitting around for a while.
For a while,
right?
Yeah.
And they haven't been updated. They don't have the later software. So some of those I imagine they'll be able to get into to one extent or another. But where you're running an iPhone 5 or later, and you're running especially 9 point whatever or later, okay, I want to see how many of these law enforcement agencies get back the data off the phone. I'm predicting the number is 0 because the FBI is lying to get out of this suit.
Okay. I'm gonna reveal a card that I've got up my sleeve on this.
Okay.
The United States Secret Service actually has a facility that's located in Oklahoma. And this facility was set up post 9/11 to be able to get various electronic devices, decrypt them, mm-hmm. and provide that information. Rather than having multiple agents trained throughout the country and spending millions upon millions of dollars in all these various data centers to be able to do this, instead they decided to have one spot.
Centralize it,
have everybody send their stuff there from multiple federal agencies because everybody else will help fund it.
Sure.
Well, the agent, the special agent who conceived this, who is also the special agent who runs this facility.
Okay, so he's the SAC.
No, he's not. He runs this department, but he has a boss.
Okay.
This is in a smaller town in Oklahoma. The boss is out of Oklahoma City.
Okay.
So, but he does run the lab, if you will. Has been a personal friend of mine since middle school. So, I'd be interested to calling him up and asking him, hey man.
Yeah.
Really, what's going on?
What's the real dope?
Well, yeah. Right, it's right. just... Do you know anything about this? It's likely he won't be able to say anything to me, or he might be able to be very frank and say, yeah, that's bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, I've got guys, guys in special forces groups, guys in federal agencies that tell me stuff all the time without coming out and saying stuff.
Right.
I'll give you an example. I've got a buddy of mine who actually works for the federal government, and he works for the military. He works on the electronic intercept side. He's sort of the military version. He works for the military version of NSA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we were talking on our cell phones one day, and I said something, and he said, don't, not on a cell phone. And that was domestically, okay? And this is one of my dearest, longest friends, okay? Either one of us would take a bullet for the other. So when he says to me, stop, don't.
You listen.
Well, he's telling me that domestic cell phone calls, because remember, the NSA's thing is we only capture calls that involve foreigners and overseas communications.
Right.
We don't capture cell phone calls domestically, cell
BS.
Phone to cell phone. Here's a guy who works in that exact field, trained by NSA, as a matter of fact. And I said something that was a little, a little edgy concerning government and my views on it. Stop, don't, not on a cell phone. What he's telling me, without revealing classified information, he's telling me, Dave, the government captures domestic cell-to-cell calls, right? And I get guys doing stuff like that with me all the time, giving me the picture without actually violating their
right.
their constraints under their top secret clearance.
Anybody who believes that the massive data collection center in Utah that the NSA has
yes.
is not collecting all of this data, it doesn't matter what the courts have to say, because they do it under the guise of national security.
Right.
And the courts have no jurisdiction over national security. Of course they collect it. Why do you think we went from analog to digital over the last 15 years? There is nothing analog left.
Right.
It is all digital. If there is anything analog, it's an analog supplement to something that's already digital. You've converted over to digital. They just haven't made you take down the analog portion
right,
of
right.
it yet.
Here's for me going to be the real acid test of this. If somebody, say, 18 months from now puts in a FOIA request to FBI or to that data center and says, how many iPhones from local law enforcement running hardware 5 or better and software 9 or better have you returned the actual data to the agency?
Uh-huh. They won't answer.
Right.
National security. We'll be right back.
We are back, and now it's time for what is up with the condition of the medical industry in America? Now, as you may have heard me comment to Bill during the first segment, this is something I was completely ignorant about. I have not been in a hospital in many, many years. I tried to think of the last time. A long time. And even then, it was simply a stay overnight because the outpatient surgery that I had, the surgeon had some difficulty with it. My 45-minute surgery ended up being 3.5 hours, and he felt I'd be better staying overnight because of the pain management issue. But there was really nothing to do other than pump me full of pain drugs, right? And then I was out the next morning, so I don't think that really counts. So that was the only time I've ever been in a hospital. So I need this surgery, and we're setting it up with the doctor's office. And the surgery scheduler, the person who has to understand what my surgery is, how long it's going to take, what time I need to arrive, give me sets of instructions, talk to me about fasting, what time I'll be going home, all of this. The surgery scheduler says, no problem, Mr. Champion. You'll arrive at the hospital at 1:30, and you'll leave at 6 p.m. Oh, great. Okay. Is that not the epitome of outpatient surgery? Right. So that's how things are scheduled, right? I'm not staying. I mean, I'm not bringing my toothbrush. So I show up in the hospital and, you know, they stick the thing in my hand and get the IV or get it prepped to have an IV. And they're talking to me about what the hospital's protocols are. Very nice nurse, by the way. She was awesome. She was very outgoing, very informative. So I have no complaints on the inbound side, right? So then the anesthesiologist comes and visits with me, and we have a few laughs. Cool guy. And he leaves, and then the doctor stops. It's standard protocol before you go under the knife. You know, the anesthesiologist visits you for a second, and then the doctor does. So I ask a question about the part about going home, and the doctor says to me, he looks shocked. He says, "You're not going home." "What?" He says, "You're not going home. This is serious surgery. Nobody goes home after this procedure." "What?" Now, I'm thinking in my head, well, your staff said I'm going home, right? How can this happen, right? The doctor saying this is serious surgery. Nobody goes home after this procedure. You stay in the hospital. And his staff has me booked as outpatient. How is this even possible? But nevertheless, here we go. So off into surgery I go. You know, say, all right, I guess I'm staying overnight. Off into surgery I go. Do I know that the surgery went well? Well, I'm hoping so. I seem to be recovering sufficiently and well enough. But since it's inside me, I can't really say whether the surgery went well or not so well. We'll see in the long run. But then I'm done with surgery, and they send me to a hospital room, right, to recover. Somehow, I have no idea how this happened. I got a private room. And during some of the time when I was out walking around, there was probably, I'm going to guess, a dozen rooms, of which two were private, and I lucked out and got the private room. I have no idea how that happened. But I was grateful. So I'm in this room, and there's these things called SCDs. And they wrap around...
STDs?
S, Sam, Charles, David.
Okay.
And they wrap around your legs from the knee to the ankle, and they look just like pieces of nylon, and they wrap around in Velcro. They've got cables connected to them, and the cable goes to some little control module that hangs off the footboard of the bed. And the purpose of these, I did not know at the time. No one had told me what they were doing, why they were there, what they were for, or I would have said turn these things on. What they do is they compress your leg from the ankle side up to the knee, and then they repeat the procedure again on both legs, and it's to keep the blood flow when you're stationary and can't move around like when you've just had surgery in your hospital bed. The reason that they created these and the reason they're important is they prevent blood clots in the lower legs, which are very common if you're laying around unable to move for days like you would be post-surgery in a hospital, right? So they're sitting right there. I have no idea what they're for. I'm whacked out of my mind on pain drugs, right, for at least the first 24 hours.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm laying there. I have no idea what these things are for. It doesn't occur to me to ask, why aren't you using them? Because my presumption is, you guys know your job, right? Well, I don't want to jump ahead, but I will tell you, I ended up going home with a blood clot because I was there for 96 hours in the hospital, and they ran those things on my legs precisely 1 hour. Now, even if we say starting like later in day two, I was up and moving around, and so once I'm up and moving around, you don't need to do it. Usually that still means it was about 36 hours when they should have been using them on me and weren't. So let's say those 36 hours that would have been mandatory under the doctrine of using them, they ran them once, 1 hour, not 36 hours, and I went home with a blood clot. By the way, you probably are aware blood clots are potentially life-threatening. Isn't that sweet? Isn't it nice that they almost kill you or set you up at risk for dying for something as simple as not running these things? So now, it's the night of the surgery. I had the surgery late in the afternoon, so I'm laying there. I don't know, it's about 8 o'clock at night. And I'm laying there in the hospital bed. They've already got me on some oral pain meds, and it comes time they're going to whack me with some morphine. Okay. Now, I'm completely a non-drug person. I mean, I almost have to fight with my conscience to take an Advil, right? I would prefer to take nothing ever. But after somebody just did some really horrific stuff to my innards, I'm all about whack me up for like 24 hours, keep me pain-free. I mean, why not? I mean, it's stupid to do otherwise since the technology exists. So they come along and they hit me with the morphine. And, you know, there's that, if you've been on morphine, you know the feeling, you know, like about 30 seconds after they do the injection, you're sitting there and all of a sudden it's like, wow. So this happens. And then I'm laying there. By the way, did you want to set that at some point?
Yes, sir.
So while I'm laying there and I suddenly get this thing that I call a glimmer of pain. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. I'm laying there, happy as a clam. I've had some oral painkillers. Now I'm on morphine. And all of a sudden, I feel this glimmer. And I'm like, what is that? And it's down at the surgery site, right? What is that? Okay. But it's a little glimmer, right? Who cares? And all of a sudden, over the next 10 minutes, that glimmer blossomed. They always ask you in the hospital, what's your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? Well, this was a 12. I had sweat pouring off of me. I was shaking. Only second time in my life I've had tears involuntarily coming out of my eyes from pain. And I'm telling the nurse, do something. I can't. Why not? It's not in the orders from the doctor. I'm in a fucking hospital. What do you mean? Get a fucking doctor up here, right? Unbelievable. I can't do anything for you because on this computer screen, it doesn't tell me that when you're in the most excruciating, arguably the most excruciating pain you've ever been in your life, it doesn't tell me I can do anything to stop that. And yeah, you're in a hospital, but there are no doctors around. Oh, what? Unbelievable. So they call the on-call doctor three times. Would you like to know how many times the on-call doctor ignored being called? Yeah, three times. So eventually, after about 30 minutes, whatever that pain episode was, it dwindled off. And so eventually, the next day, or maybe it could have been very, very, very late in the morning, 2, 3 in the morning, got a call, kind of blurs now. A doctor does show up, not the one who was originally on call. And he works with me to change some of the meds and to allow the nurses to facilitate what needs to be done should I have another one of those pain episodes, which I had two more. And I'm very grateful that he did that because instead of a 12, they came in at about a 9. Absolutely horrible, but I'll take 9 over 12 any day. They then did it. They had all this equipment plugged into me, and I started to swell. My abdomen started swelling, just huge. I walked in the door at 230 pounds. By the afternoon of day two, I looked like I was a 300 pounder. And the shocking thing is nobody there saw a problem. No problem. You walked in looking like a 230-pound man. Now you look like a 300-pound man. We see no problem with this. Okay? So by the morning of day three, I'm so large. I hate to be graphic, but I'm so large, I can't reach around and take care of my business with the toilet paper. That's how gigantic I had become. And the staff still saw no problem. That's some scary stuff. So finally, I told them, I said, I'm going to rip all of these things out of me unless you take them out. I don't care what the consequences are physically for me. I don't care what the consequences are to you. I don't care what the consequences are on any level. You people are harming me. You're not helping me. You're not fixing me. You're not healing me. You are sending me towards the path of dying. So finally, one of those RNs says to me, are you ordering me to take it out? Yes. I guess there's some protocol where you have to say it in just certain words. So they unplugged me. They sent me for a CT scan. My torso is filled with fluid, having nothing to do with the operation of the organs. In between the organs, okay, sets you up for peritonitis, sets you up for sepsis, both of those potentially deadly. And I'm telling them, look what's happening. Look what's happening.
Were you like the blueberry girl in Willy Wonka?
Dude,
sorry.
You can cut to the two shot. Dude, I've got to tell you, I look like the Michelin man, okay? I mean, literally, like, as I'm sitting here now, I can pinch a little fat. I was so bloated with fluids, I could literally, like, grab...
Lift up.
Handfuls, like I was obese. And the hospital staff didn't see anything wrong.
They should have put a spigot in you and opened it up.
It was crazy. It was just absolutely crazy. So I came
and
home.
All of this from a full frontal lobotomy. You right. Would never think.
And here I am. So it didn't work. But I told them, I said, I have a nasal infection and I have an eye infection. The managing nurse, that's like the administrative nurse over all the other nurses, mm-hmm. told me, oh, no, you don't. That's just an after effect of anesthesia. Now, of course, I thought that was insane. When I got home, I searched far and wide on the internet. There's no after effect of anesthesia. So they sent me home with an eye infection. They sent me home with a nasal infection.
And a blood clot.
They sent me home with certain medical implements still connected to me and no antibiotics, which is way outside protocols. You send somebody home with any medical implements still plugged into them. Antibiotics go with them. It's part of the protocol.
Right.
And they sent me home with a blood clot.
What hospital were you admitted into, and this went down?
They're all the same Desert View. It's the one up there on 95, almost into North Las Vegas, on the west side of it as you're going north on the 95.
I just want to make sure.
No, Mountain View. I don't want to get the wrong hospital.
Yeah,
Mountain
Desert View is Mountain
View.
I
don't want to condemn the wrong guy. Mountain View.
Okay.
But
I just want to make sure of where not to go with it. For my entire life growing up in Las Vegas, Valley Hospital was a place to go.
Oh, well.
And it's been there forever, and I still believe today, from information I get from people in the industry, it's still the place to go.
Well, I can certainly tell you that Mountain View is not. If you live in Vegas or you're visiting Vegas and they try and put you in Mountain View, run!
Put your crazy uncle in there that you don't like anymore.
There you go.
All right, we'll be back. Welcome back. Time for my rant. You know what really grinds my gears? People who are so self-absorbed, they just don't get it. Really, this is something that bothers my brother as well. Bothers my father, so I'm wondering if this is a little bit genetic, that it bothers all of us. I'll give you a perfect example. You're standing there having a conversation with someone, and somebody else comes up and just starts running their jib about whatever they wanted to talk about. Never mind that you're already involved in a conversation, someone else just butts right in. You know, I'm generally the type of person, if I know the person who's doing the butting in, I'll stop them and say, excuse me, we're involved in a conversation here, please wait till we're done. I don't do that generally if I don't know the person that's coming in to butt in, because they're butting in to talk to the other person I'm speaking with. I don't know who they are, but it's like, how rude. Another thing about being self-absorbed, when you cause an issue yourself, and then you scramble and disrupt a whole bunch of other people's lives and schedules because of a problem you created, it's now an emergency upon the backs of everybody else. And then you still fail to recognize it was completely self-induced, this issue, and you created it on your own. I'll give you a perfect example of this. It's well known that I chair the Nycanny Republican Party. Next week when we do this show, I will still be the chair of the Nycanny Republican Party. The week after that, I won't be. I announced in January to my executive committee that I'm resigning my post after the April meeting, at some point during later in the April meeting of 2016. Reason being, I've been doing it for 4 years. I've had my fill. It's time for someone else to come around. It really is. We've gotten a lot of good things going in the right direction. In my 4 years as chairman, we've had three vice chairmen. First one, Edmund Gibran. Good guy. Did some of the work. The main thing for the vice chairman is to actually organize the precincts and the precinct captains and the base. That's really their job within the bylaws. Edmund did somewhat of a job at that, but not a whole bunch. Keeping in mind, this guy owned a business out of state that he was back and forth to often. Next, after Edmund ended up resigning for the next, about 7 months or so, local guy Andy Alberti, he was vice chairman. Well, Andy accomplished nothing as vice chairman. He talked about accomplishing a lot of stuff, but he never actually picked up the phone and made the calls. He picked up the phone and made 5 or 6 phone calls, if I remember the story right, and didn't make the other 24 phone calls, but complained about it for 2 months. So I made those other 24 phone calls in a matter of about 90 minutes and got all the information we needed. Nothing carried on from there. For the last less than a year, Leo Blundo, who owns Carmela's Bistro, has been serving as a vice chair. Talks good game, hasn't really done much of anything when it comes to organizing the precincts as far as I could see. If anything happened, it was beyond my scope. Then it comes to the caucus that we have recently in February 23rd. Now, the caucus is organized in general terms by the state party. And then in each county, the county parties facilitate that. So that's the way it goes. We hired a woman by the name of Carla Perkins, who's done the last two caucuses before that, last three now, to organize our caucus. She did a wonderful job. We had just barely enough volunteers to get stuff done. And at the caucus, during in the precinct meetings, that's where you put your hand up and say, I want to be a delegate to the county convention. Each precinct has its own number of delegates. Well, our sitting vice chairman at the time, Leo Blundo, decided, well, I'm vice chairman. I must be an automatic delegate. I'm not going to bother to put my name on the list. No, he did not put his name on the list for his precinct, Precinct 16. There's 9 delegates available. When I got the paperwork, there was only 7 names on there. Leo's name was not there. Now, it took me about, 2 weeks to actually see all of this. Wow, what's the story here? Someone else pointed it out to me. Well, Leo tells me in a text message he figured he was automatically going to be a delegate because he was vice chair, and since I was chair, I should be automatic delegate. Well, there's nothing in any paperwork, no rules, no bylaws, no Nevada law, statutes, nothing that provides for automatic delegation at all, regardless of your position. As the chairman, I became a delegate for my precinct. The secretary and the treasurer each did it from their precincts. Why did the vice chairman not do it? So then he asked me to just add his name onto the list. And I will say this, I believe this was on a phone call, so I can't confirm this, but if my recollection is correct, he asked me to put his name in one of those open spots. You can't do that. That's called fraud. And asking me to do it on your behalf is conspiracy to commit fraud. Both are felonies. I'm not going to do that. So then we have somebody at the state party interpret a particular Nevada law. Could we hold a meeting and appoint people specially? Well, we end up holding a meeting the day before the county convention. Should we appoint Leo Blundo as a delegate to Precinct 16? Should we appoint anybody else in any of these positions that are so far unfilled? So we had a long, I opened this thing up, not biased either way. A lot of people came. So you got dozens of people now inconvenienced to come to this special meeting because one guy thought, well, my position means some sort of king. I should live by a different set of rules than everybody else. Not the case. So we have the special meeting. We have a vote. Well, the vote gets shot down. We are not going to appoint people because the way the law reads, we don't believe we can. The way I interpreted the law was it was quite specific. It said, if you call for precinct meeting, properly notified, and nobody shows up, then the entire central committee can then appoint delegates who live in that precinct to be delegates to the county convention. Well, that was in precincts 5 and 8, I think, this year, are the only two that we called for, nobody showed up. It doesn't say anything in there about being able to do that in precincts that held meetings, but they didn't quite get their full delegate count. So the membership voted, no bueno. So the next day we have our county convention, and we pass bylaws, do some amendments, do some changes, and in there is if you are an elected officer or have an elected position within the Republican Party here in Nye County, and you fail to maintain your membership in good standing, then your position is automatically considered vacated. So now as soon as the drop of the gavel goes, our vice chairman is no longer vice chairman, not even a member any longer. Then a week later, we're at another meeting, and he gets all kinds of tuned up, pissed off at me for saying, hey, man, I need to get access to the email. Now, for 2 days, ignoring text messages to the effect, I need to get access to the email account. I'm going to need to get your key back to the office, things such as that, right? Absolutely. And this is with our party secretary there as well. In my opinion, absolutely unhelpful at all. Just completely, totally just trying to block the and being in denial of this whole thing. And I asked, why are you being so difficult? The response I got, as I recall, was, it's my prerogative.
Passive aggressive?
Could be, Dave. Matter of fact, let's fill in Dave here. So we end up having this situation. I'm like, why are you being so difficult? The response I got was, because that's my prerogative. All right, well, I need your key back. Then, I want someone else other than the party secretary here for me to hand this key back over to and witness this. How many witnesses were there when I handed you? So, then he demands for me to take his...
Who is this doing all this?
Leo Blundo.
I want to make sure that I was connecting... Yeah, because I heard you mention him. But...
Well, you'll see his name because he's running for county commission.
I saw that, yes.
Yes, okay. So now we've got this deal where he wants to insist that his code be taken out of the alarm pad. And he's standing there watching. For me to do this, I have to put in the master code.
Right.
That only me and the person who installed the system know. We're the only two who know that master code. Because I was chairman when it got put in. The next chairman, they'll know the master code. Well, I'm not going to do that in front of you. Are you going to remove my code? No, I'm going to make it my prerogative to be difficult. F.O. Get out. So I took him out 5 minutes after that, took him off the bank account, all this stuff, just because he was being a complete jackass. Did end up getting a hold of the webmaster to get the email. Just made it as difficult as possible. Then, in the newspaper...
Wait, are you sure a guy you want to have come alongside you, huh?
Oh, yeah. Then, in the newspaper last Friday, they did an expose on him, and they're doing it on all the county commissioners. And it says, local GOP leader running for county commission. So it says that he was the chairman of the NICAN Republican Party. So I shoot off a text message to both Daria Sokolova, who wrote the article, and Arnold Knightley, who is the the editor, that this is not the case. He used to be vice chairman, but he's not anymore. Hasn't been vice chairman since the winter, actually. That was like the day or two before spring. So then I wrote a letter to the editor, which was published in the Wednesday paper this week, clarifying that. And, of course, this guy puts it up, and he's not clarifying any of that. It's just whatever. And he also was taking credit from what I was told.
I take it the shoddy journalism was the PVT?
Shoddy journalism. And both the writer and the editor have my phone number, my cell phone number. We've all texted about different things, and they know how to get a hold of me if they want to cross-reference something, not just put it in there. Every decent journalist should second source. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
That is part of journalism.
Yes.
Second sourcing. Otherwise, it's an editorial. So.
Also referred to as confirmation.
Yeah. So the question is, who gave them the information he was chairman? Well, likely the source, Leo Blundo. I don't know for sure. I wasn't there. But I do know this, that when you have people who totally refuse to take any sort of personal accountability, when they screw something up and soak up a lot of time, effort, energy from a whole bunch of other people in the process, and they're unapologetic about it, and then they are a complete asswipe about it when you have to do what you need to do in the wake of this thing, part of your duties, and you get treated like the bad guy. I got to tell you, absolutely not. So I will no longer be eating at Carmelo's Bistro. And I got to tell you, I enjoyed the food.
Yep.
But knowing that this is the type of guy that I'm dealing with, I'm not going to. There was even an allegation from a woman that I know that worked for him for one night as a waitress. She alleges that when customers would pay with credit cards and leave their tips on those, he would not reimburse those tips. And someone else I know who used to be in the service industry tells me they alleged that they addressed him about it, and he confirmed it.
Well, I'll tell you, when I ate there one time, I ordered and expressed an interest in another dish. And he said, would you like to sample that? Now, what does sample mean?
Sample is a little sample plate.
He brought out that entire dish and put it on my bill. I've never gone back. I don't like to be treated that way.
Anyhow, I'm just telling you, vote who you want to vote for in that commission district. If I was living in that commission district, Leo Blundo's the last person I would vote for. But that's just my opinion.
And we'll be back.
Or a little bit less fat.
Yeah.
Is that because of the bloating is gone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Welcome back. So was it like birthing water?
Yeah, we were just talking. I don't know.
Welcome back to segment four, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know if the audience can tell. One of the reasons I had the surgery is because what was going on was causing me to constantly bloat.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'm like, it's like flat like it's supposed to be, and that's a pleasure.
Nice. Yeah. You bring the six pack, I bring the pony cake.
There you go.
Welcome back to segment four. This is where we talk about emails you send us. We got a couple of good doozies that are here.
Yes.
You can always send this to us at daveandbillshow@gmail.com right here on the bottom of the screen as well. You can go online and catch up on all of the episodes that we've done up to this point. I still have a couple to upload, but I'm getting to those. And you can always find those online right here at totallyunprepared.info. Turn that on to your friends and family and everybody else who wants to listen to us ramble on about a thing or two.
Yeah, see some good media rather than some trash media.
So we got a good one that came in from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Wow.
And in Michigan, if you have a concealed carry permit, a license, CPL they call it, in Michigan, you are allowed to carry exposed on a school campus, even if that campus is a gun-free zone. So there's been a guy.
Michigan did something right.
They did. There's a guy that lives there. He's got a three-year-old son who's in a music class.
Three-year-old?
Three-year-old
son. Or a third grader?
No, three-year-old. Toddler. It's a music class that they do. It's kind of an outreach deal.
All right.
So he goes in once a week with his son to this music class, and he packs. Well, all of the other parents are all up in arms about this. The superintendent of the district, the principal of the school, they can't do anything because it's covered by law. So they've actually had special meetings to talk about what can be done. So, Dave, tell me what they did about this. Can you guess what they did about this one?
Yes. I'm going to guess it's something along the line. Do they call the cops?
Yes, they did.
Okay. And I'm going to guess the cops, this is always an edgy one because it depends on what cop arrives. Whether the cop is going to say, I don't care what the law is, I'm going to arrest you, or whether the cop turns to the administrator and says, I'm sorry, there's something I can do.
Which oftentimes is a well-informed person that's being called on. Hey, look, here's the law.
Right.
Okay? There's not going to be any illegal arrest going on. Here's the law. Check it out. I'll stand here and wait. So what they do now is they actually have police come to the school and wait for this guy to come when it's time for his son's music class and escort him around the campus and stay with him while he's there. They literally say in there, the principal has said, that he's bringing more guns in to deal with the gun that's coming in.
You know, Bill, when I first moved to Pahrump, you remember I open carried almost exclusively. After years in California, it was such a joy, right? And I would go into local restaurants, and occasionally, and this always seemed to be like mid-50s women, okay? Young women didn't seem to care. Men didn't seem to care. Women in their 70s and 80s, it always seemed to be about this menopause-age women.
That is exactly the demographic that ever addresses me about it.
Right. And I would walk into a restaurant, and I would see them, you know, one of these, they're like, you know, and in a couple of cases, because I usually know the management of the restaurants where I eat, I found out that these women in these demographics had complained to the management that there was an armed person in the restaurant, in Pahrump of all places, right, where it's fairly common, right? But here was my thinking. This goes back to your story. Never once did they get up, one of them rush out, the other one run and throw some money on the counter and get the hell out of there because it was a man with a gun. Never once. They'd do this, they'd complain, but they would sit there. Now, you would think after they sat there, I don't know how many different times with other people with guns in Pahrump, 30 minutes this time, 45 minutes that time, an hour that time, and nothing ever happened. You would think they'd go like, huh, stop, pause, reevaluate. Armed people around me. Nothing happened.
Obviously, people who are either not from here or haven't been here that long.
Yeah, well, but it goes back to my thing with the school, right? This guy comes to the school. Nothing happens. I'm speaking before they decided to get the cops involved. He goes to the school. Nothing happens. 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 Bing! Why does the light not go on? Armed man, nothing happens. Law-abiding citizen, connect the freaking dots. It's the stupidity of these kind of people. I mean, from the principal, no less. Get this guy out of the education field. He's too much of a moron to be in the educational field.
I was in northern Arizona in some little, literally, roadside restaurant just recently, carrying openly. I mean, it's Arizona. You can carry concealed without a permit. Carrying openly. I'm walking out. I guess it was a convenience store. I'd stopped in there to get gas, went in there, paid, come back out. And as I'm walking out, there's a woman and her daughter, a young daughter, that are coming out. She's probably grade school age. And I'm, you know, there's a set of double doors in an L shape, and I'm opening the doors and, you know, holding them for them. And, you know, usually what's a nice thing to do when somebody's like, oh, thank you.
Right.
Yeah. Nothing. And I'm standing there literally waiting, waiting. Come on. Okay. Let me get waiting, waiting. And usually when all that's done, if I don't hear anything, I'll say, don't mention it.
Good for you.
So
that's awesome.
That's what I did this time. And I knew why she didn't say thank you, because I'm carrying a gun openly, and on the back of their little minivan, her husband's over there tooling around in the minivan. They got another child in there, California plates.
Right.
And, you know, I could just feel it. This. You know, and I'm like, you know, why are you judging me? I mean, you're from California. Your husband drives a minivan. Should I consider him metrosexual?
Right.
I'm not going to jump to that conclusion because it's guns haven't really changed all that much. It's just been the attitude towards guns. You know, there used to be the NRA would come in and have all kinds of shooting leagues in junior high and high schools.
Yeah.
The older high schools and junior highs in this country that have been around for 40, 50 years,
yeah,
have rifle ranges in the basements in most of them still.
Students used to walk to and from school with their rifle.
Yes, they did.
Yes.
Now it's a SWAT call out.
Crazy.
If you have a squirt gun. So speaking about these guns, somebody has designed a concealed carry gun that looks like an iPhone.
Oh, it looks like a cell phone. A lot like Bill's phone here. He's got a case on his, is the reason I hold it up. You can see it's a little bit thicker than mine because I don't have a case on mine right now.
It's going to break by the end of the day.
Yeah, and what happens is a portion of it swings down and becomes the grip, and as it swings down, it reveals a little trigger. And the upper portion of the phone has two barrels in it.
So it's it's basically a Derringer cell phone.
It is a last ditch, oh shit, two shots self defense tool. Okay. So our good friend Chuck Schumer.
Oh. Love that guy. He's a perfect example of a bad example.
Yes. I mean, if there's anybody who is more rabidly anti-gun without rational thought in his head, it's Chuck Schumer. The fact that he's a senator, this is like the principle I said shouldn't be in education.
And let's talk about hypocrisy. When Remington opened a new factory just a few years ago in northern New York, who was there to help dedicate the building and the factory? Chuck Schumer.
Yeah. With his armed security.
Yes.
Yeah. So these guys don't hate guns. They don't hate guns. They hate guns in the hands of honest, law-abiding Americans.
Yes.
But anyway, so Chuck Schumer holds this press conference where he's talking about the fact that this gun should not be made. And this may be one of the few times in history, probably the only time in history, that I happen to agree with Chuck Schumer. And the reason is, I don't have any objection per se to somebody whipping out their cell phone and shooting a felon. I mean, who would mind that, right? The problem is we talk a lot on this show about illegal and needless police violence.
Yeah, you can imagine that if you got a cop that for some reason or another decides that somebody needs to get shot merely because they're holding a cell phone and they can articulate, well, we've seen that this thing is on the market, and the way that they grabbed for that phone made me fear for my life. I believe that myself or somebody else could have been in imminent jeopardy of life or serious bodily injury, so I needed to, you know, use my gun and stop them.
Not just the bad cops. If those cell phone guns catch on, what kind of pressure does it put on the good cops? I mean, they're not going to want to shoot. I mean, the bad cops want to shoot you no matter what, right? The good cops, they don't want to shoot you. But like everybody else, they want to go home and see their kids.
Sure, yeah.
And all of a sudden now, every time they give a command, somebody's got a cell phone. I mean, talk about...
Stop pointing that gun at me. It's just a camera, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, bang, bang, you're dead, right?
Yeah.
Talk about the wrong tool at the wrong time in America.
Yeah.
I mean, this is giving every bad cop the excuse he wants, and it's putting incredible pressure on good cops. Guns are recognizable as guns, and should be. Maybe rare exceptions. Okay. They should be recognizable as guns. You start making them look like car keys, cell phones, notepads.
I wonder, David,
it's
if it'll
a
get,
bad move.
I wonder if it will get ATF approval because you know as well as I do, in order to be able to manufacture and sell guns from a manufacturing and FFL standpoint, the ATF has certain criteria, approval or denial. So I wonder if it'll get approval. Do you remember, I think it was the Chris, they came up with something that folded all up and could fit in a cargo pocket.
The V-Chris.
The V-Chris, yes.
You know what? I would probably give up one of my testicles for a full-auto V-Chris.
Now, didn't you send in a letter trying to buy one of those? I had a plan on that.
But I was sidetracked with other things.
All right, good.
So, yeah, that's interesting. And lastly, the one about ISIS.
Okay. Oh, yeah, this is beautiful.
Time is short. The CENTCOM, which was running the war over the Middle East, they're saying, we're kicking the butts of ISIS, right? And their intel analysts are saying, hang on, no, we're not. Not even a little.
Nowhere's near that.
Right, like you're saying, like it's on a scale of 1 to 10, it's 9.5, and we're saying it's 0.5, right? So CENTCOM is putting all these analysts, is sidelining them, screwing up their careers, sending them back to the States. And the reality is, here's what you get when the CIA is running ISIS. The CIA is running ISIS, and the generals know it. Okay? I mean, it's an open secret within the military at that level, right? So the generals still want the public to think, yeah, we're doing war against ISIS, the CIA contracts. Although we can't say that. And then the analysts are going, dude, that's not what's happening. But they've got to sideline and punish these analysts for telling the truth to protect the fact that CIA is running ISIS.
Yeah. So we've got CIA on one side, Pentagon on the other. It's all messed
up. Crazy.
All right. Thanks, guys. We'll be back next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.